I want to back up just for a minute and cover something I don't think we covered adequately from last week's lesson, then jump into our lesson for today. This is from Ecclesiastes 3. It says, man cannot find out the work that man has done from the beginning even unto the end. But I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it. There is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. That which is has been already, and that which will he has already been. For God seeks what has passed by. I think that's a really interesting contrast about the surety of God's work and his hand. And Isaiah 46, 9 through 11, gives us some really great insights into this as well. It says, remember the former things long past. In other words, Israel's about ready to be taken captive. Isaiah was writing during the time of the northern captivity. People are discouraged. Has God forsaken us? And he goes, look at your long history. For I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is no one like me. Declaring the end from the beginning. In other words, because I am God and I dwell in eternity, I can tell the future. And from ancient times, things have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established. And I will accomplish all my good pleasure, calling the bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country. Truly I have spoken, truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it, and surely I will do it. So he's talking here about the messianic hope that ultimately will turn this all around. And I think it's fascinating that he's taking credit here for these acts of nature, this bird of prey from the east that does this migration. I'm involved in all that. My purpose is at hand. And ultimately, I'm going to bring about my will, and you can count on that. So I think that's a helpful reminder, particularly when we look around us and we see that things don't appear to be working out as we might have hoped. The first part of Ecclesiastes chapter 4 is talking about discouragement, and particularly when it appears that evil regimes and evil in general is triumphing over good. He says, verse 4 and verse 1, chapter 4, verse 1, then I returned and saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, and there were no comforter. I look at the poor people of North Korea today. We look at some of the things that are going on in certain of the African countries and how they seem to be overrun with terrorists and trauma and poverty and wow, what is life like for those people? And so he looks around in his day at these awful circumstances where it doesn't appear that these people have any hope. And he says, probably better in those circumstances if you were never born. I mean, it's just very kind of dismal. But then he turns around and he says, verse 4, then I saw all labor and every skillful work. And for this, a man is often envied of his neighbor. This also was vanity. I thought this was kind of humorous almost. He says, but then I looked around and I saw, yes, that there is benefits in a hardworking person who becomes industrious and can succeed. But the downside of that is he that has a place in the sun is apt to get blistered. that oftentimes you work hard and you're successful and people envy you. And then they want to criticize you, and they want to try to pull you down. And so he says, well, that is a purpose in life, is also something that is lacking. But on the other hand, he says, just because that's likely to happen, he says, it's the fool that foldeth his hands together and eateth his own flesh. In other words, the answer to that is not to try to do your best, obviously. But then he talks about what is known as the golden mean. And I think this has just a lot of value. My dad used to talk about this a lot. He says, if you're going to have a balanced life, if you're going to have a meaningful life, remember, this book is about what life's all about. He says, you want to have one hand filled with labor and one hand filled with quietness. If you haven't marked that in your Bible, that'd be a good thing to do. Better is a handful with quietness than two handfuls with labor and striving after the wind. So there's this balance, is there not, in life between work and play? What a blessing worthwhile work and a good job can be. One hand filled with quietness. I think of Psalm 46:10. Be still and know that I am God. Is it difficult sometimes in our busy, hectic lives to maybe turn off the noise and just have some quietness? To be still and know that I am God? Isaiah 30, verse 15. In quietness and in confidence is your strength. I mean, it may be you only have time for a 10-minute quiet time or devotional, but that may be the most significant 10 or 15 minutes of your day. Gives you a sense of direction and purpose. So do you take time for quietness and meditation to be holy? What are your thoughts about this balance between work and play and the challenge that we have in doing that? Yes, Barry. Three 3,000 years ago. That's all right. You're an engineer. I'll forgive you.
In his day and time, he was still saying, be still. As though it's so easy to get caught up in that everyday work of life, do things, go, 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 all the time. Yeah, we think it's so unique to our world and our fast-paced world. It goes further to say, the earlier verses that say, nothing's changed.
I do think we have more, opportunities for distraction today than they did. But that doesn't mean they didn't have many things that could distract them also. Yes, it is a relative point. One of the reasons why I love this passage so much, I'm sorry, yes, Jonathan. Thank you, Lyle. Yeah, and 3,000 years ago, they were talking about the importance of finding this balance. And we certainly have a challenge with this today as well. Yes, Pat.
Oh, my translation translates.
Okay. The quietness. Yeah. Being thankful for what you have now rather than constantly thinking, I'm going to be happy when I get something else. He goes on to say about balance here, you know, work hard. You know, as Jonathan just said, the fool foldeth his hands together. There's lots of verses in the Bible that condemn slothfulness, laziness. So he says, work hard, but not too hard. In other words, I think Mark Miller last week brought up Psalm 127, verse 2. It is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors. In other words, be a workaholic. For he gives to his beloved his sleep. Sometimes when you got lots to do and you start getting tired, you get frustrated. You have to spend about 1/3 of your life in bed. You know, it'd be nice if we could have more productive hours. But this seems to tell us that actually rejuvenation and rest and even the dreaming process releases psychological stress that otherwise, you know, takes its toll. Don't resent the hours you spend sleeping. Try to have a schedule so you sleep well and benefit from that blessing, which is also from God. That's also a part of balance. Yes, Jennifer. Yeah, and David also talked about meditating upon his bed at night, you know, thinking about God before he went to sleep, which is, you know, a very good practice as well, to try to say a prayer and think about spiritual things to kind of give you a center. I think it also helped you have better dreams if you speak to the shepherd, right, instead of counting sheep. Yes, Chase. Okay, so again, we're talking about avoiding extremes, right? Here he's talking about, you know, rising up early and retiring late and missing your sleep. But on the other hand, he says, don't fall in love with sleep so that you don't get up and have a productive day. So perfect, thank you. That's a good example of balance. Fatigue makes cowards of us all. Yes, Gail. Yeah, that's another advantage of this balance. And sometimes folks just allow themselves to get on such a treadmill that they take on too much. And then they live this constant sleep deficit, and then they wonder why everything seems to be a drag. All right, Psalm what? Psalm. Okay. All right. Psalm 137. Any rate, sometimes the difference between hope and despair is a good night's rest. And just a lot of truth in that. It's fascinating. Elijah was discouraged, even suicidal. And he's just saying after he had this great victory that, you know, he has to flee for his life. And Ahab and Jezebel are after him. And first thing God tells him to do, he doesn't rebuke him really initially. He just says, basically, there's a tree nearby. Why don't you take a nap? You know, and then why don't you get up and get something to eat? And then he gets something to eat and he says, why don't you take another nap? I mean, now he says, now can we talk? You know, this is foolishness. I got work for you to do. I just think that's fascinating how God handled Elijah in a moment of exhaustion when he was saying foolish things. So the golden mean, my dad had a knack at important times in my life, transitional times, to write me this personal handwritten, you know, father-son letter. And I remember he gave me a letter as I was flying away to Florida to go to college. You know, I was just 18. It was a long way away from home. And, you know, it was kind of scary time. And it was just such a comforting thing to read that on the plane. And he gave me some very good advice. And he said, son, I want you to work hard and play hard. That was his advice for me, along with some other things. But what he told me was, he says, if you schedule your time and you really work hard on your studies and get that done first, then when it's time to play, you can really enjoy your play time because you know your work's done. But if you procrastinate and you don't keep up with your studies and you're out playing too much, you can't even enjoy your play time because in the back of your mind, you're knowing you're being irresponsible. That was such good counsel.
Good question.
You know, I handled it real well and got straight A's. And I played as well. And I think I pulled this off, thankful to this verse, which was in that letter, and my father's counsel. And it was kind of funny. I can tell you a little side note. You know, the Florida College campus is small, and there was a blessing in that. You knew everybody, and it was like walk out the door, and it's a social life. And so it was hard sometimes to focus on your study. So thinking about this and how I was going to apply it, I asked one of the professors there if at night when they were gone, if I could have a key to their office, because I said the library is not a place where you go to study. That's where you go to get a date. I mean, literally, you're constantly distracted and it was hard to concentrate. So this person said, "You're serious, aren't you?" I go, "Yeah." I said, "I want to get straight A's here. I want to really work hard. But I also want to play hard. It's hard to separate it here. In the dorm, in the library, you can't get away." And so I would, from about 7 to 10, I would go up there in the office and I'd just kind of disappear. And I laid everything out and I just studied. And so it was really kind of humorous to me because nobody ever saw me studying because I wasn't in the library. I was in this office. And so people thought I was getting straight A's without studying. Little did they know how hard I had to work. I didn't say anything about it, but but no, actually, I figured this out early in life, and it really helped a lot. Work hard and play hard. If you know your work is done, then you can enjoy your playtime. If not, even your playtime is ruined. All right, so work plus contentment equals a key. 1 Timothy 6, godliness with contentment is great gain. So that goes back to this idea again of quietness and contentment going together, enjoying the moment, not having regrets over the past, and be fretful over the future. Too much work destroys health and time for friends and the value of companionship, which is what he moves into next. And I just love this beautiful statement here about the value of friends and companionship and making time for what's important, and that is relationships. But before we get off this, anybody have any other thoughts about this balance between work and play? And yes.
I think it's interesting. Something in the Jewish community they have is Shabbat. So from Friday night until Saturday, they have no technology. They only breathe. And you know, they keep Sabbath, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, there's a reason why in the Old Testament God said on the seventh day, it wasn't just a day of worship, it was that, but you know, it was a day of rest. And work was forbidden because he knew that these people needed at least one day off. We're blessed in our country, most of us, to get 2 days off instead of just one. But there obviously was a need for rejuvenation and time and a ceasing of work. And I think it's too bad that in our culture, Sunday, a day of worship, a day set aside for the Lord, for most people is just another day to do whatever you want and to keep, you know, your frenzied activity. Used to be Chick-fil-A didn't stand out as a place who's closed on Sunday so that you can be with family and you can worship and you can have a day off. Used to be that was pretty much the norm. And in fact, I'm encouraged. I read recently that Hungary and Poland are passing laws that are going back to this idea that Sundays businesses are closed. As a nation, they want to go back to the tradition of encouraging people to worship and have faith and family time instead of just work, work, work. It's kind of a reaction against secularism. I thought that was refreshing, actually, to hear that kind of thing going on. So our society is not going to do that. In fact, more and more people have to work on Sundays, and the employer acts like, well, who cares that this is the day of worship because they're secular. So we just need to take a stand and try to make sure that we adequately have this kind of balance in our life. Okay, part of this balance is the value of companionship. Enjoyment comes in sharing and giving, not in isolation and taking, and not in just work, 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 work. Though working hard is a good thing. Churchill said this, we make a living by what we get, we make a life by what we give. Let's read together this section here on companionship. This is verses 7 through 12. Then I returned and saw vanity under the sun. There is one that is alone, and he hath not a second. Yea, he hath neither son nor brother. Yet is there no end to all his labor, neither are his eyes satisfied with riches. You know, I'm thinking of Dickens' The Christmas Carol. And Todd, we saw that recently together. Who does this remind you of? Somebody who has no friends and all he does is work and count his money. Yes, isn't that the description of Scrooge in The Christmas Carol? I mean, exactly. Here we go. You know, there's nothing new under the sun. And of course, this guy is miserable. And what wakes him up is getting a chance to watch everybody the way they react when they hear he's dead, right? He's like, what? You know, and that really caused him to reevaluate his life and to be more generous. It's interesting to me, the root word for miserable is the word miser. Someone who's a miser is miserable by very definition. And that was Scrooge. And this is saying, basically, I saw a Scrooge, and wow, what vanity that was. But then he goes on and he says, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. My dad used to say, many hands make for light work. So, you know, let's help do things together, right? Gail and I have learned making the bed is so much easier with two than with one. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth and had not another to lift him up. You're going through a hard time. You have no one to talk to. Someone has said, your real friends are those you can call at 2 a.m. and they're not mad at you. But it's okay because they know you're hurting and I'm there for you. Again, if two lie together, then they have warmth. But how can one be warm alone? And if a man prevail against him that is alone, two shall withstand him. For a threefold cord is not quickly broken. When I was in high school, one of my favorite groups was Three Dog Night. I haven't been to many concerts in my life, but we did go to a Three Dog Night concert. And it's not just celebrate, dance to the music. It's just a number of their songs that were very interesting to me. And one of the things that I particularly liked was learning about their name. Does anybody know where the name Three Dog Night came from and what it actually represents? The Aborigines, you know, to stay warm at night when it got cold, would sleep with their dogs. And so, you know, if it was cold, you know, you'd get a dog, one of those big dogs to kind of, you know, kind of be, I guess, a kind of a canine hot water bottle, for lack of a better term, you know. I mean, you know, kind of keeps you warm. And then if it got particularly cold, you'd get a second dog, so you got a dog on both sides. But if it was a blizzard and it was really, really cold, it was a three-dog night. Have a dog on both sides and a dog laying on top of you, and it gets you through the night. Otherwise, you'd freeze. That's the idea of a three-dog night. What an interesting name for a rock group. In other words, you know, my music is so good, I'll get you through the tough time, seems to be the idea. So this isn't a sexual reference at all. This is just the idea, you know, that Eskimos will tell you that, you know, you can snuggle up together in that igloo, you can stay alive, where if you were apart on both sides, you might freeze because of the body heat and the shared warmth that keeps each other alive. That's true physically and that's true emotionally, don't you think? Sometimes do you need people just to be there for you because you're having a three-dog night emotionally and you just need that affirmation? Yes. Okay. And to constantly maybe in your time of quietness, think about what really matters and not just get caught up so much in a rat race. One of their songs that fits their name is One is the Loneliest Number That You'll Ever Know. And boy, they can really sing that. And how appropriate given sort of the name of their group. Yes. Yes. Oh, I think that fits beautifully. In fact, that's sort of where I was headed. And so very good, Pat. It's another one of those great Pat answers. Two are better than one. How so? You know, I've mentioned this to you before. I was very busy and involved as a young single person. But when I really recognized that I was sort of feeling lonely and wanted a companion was when I would be there in my apartment or my dorm room or whatever, eating alone. You know, Gail's been gone the last 4 or 5 days. People laugh and say, oh, you gotta have the TV dinners when she's visiting the grandkids. I go, no, it's not the TV dinners I mind, it's eating alone I mind. I don't miss her cooking, I miss her. So two are better than one, right? I mean, there's just, food is just made to be shared, it seems to me. It's so much better to eat with someone. Hard for one, easy for two. Yes, Lyle.
I always think of the church as being, that's one of the big benefits that we have from the church, is that we support each other. Our purpose, is one of our main purposes, is to be helping each other to get to heaven. And I think about when you have logs on a fire, when they're together, they're radiating heat.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. If somebody was asking about why is it so important to worship and to be together in a church family, and they were sitting in front of a fireplace, and they took the tongs where there were some coals there, and they took one of the coals and just set it off the side, and within no time at all, it turned black, and it was no longer glowing. And then he took the coal and he put it back, and it immediately began glowing. And God knows we need each other. God knows we need family. We are made for community. We are not made for isolation. We are made not for independence, but interdependence. And so we ought to complement and fulfill each other. Doesn't it encourage you when you hear other people praising God together and knowing they have a common faith? Absolutely. Even in paradise, think about that. Perfection. Adam was not happy without Eve. And God looked at Adam alone and said, that's not good. And so we are made for companionship. Divorced and widowed men on average live 10 years less than married men. Men especially have a hard time living alone after being happily married. My dad prayed that he would predecease my mother. He recognized that. So what do they recommend for widows and widowers? One of the first things a grief counselor will tell you, not necessarily run out on a rebound and get on some website and immediately rush into another relationship, but they tell you to lean upon friends and get a pet. Seriously, a beloved pet can enforce the immune system and increase the lifespan. Even that kind of companionship is better than being alone. So let's talk about this threefold cord. This is taken from Clinton and Elisa's wedding ceremony that we did. Also did something very identical for my two daughters when they got married. And it comes from this passage. You have chosen to benefit from this strong three-strand cord type of support and companionship. May the third strand that is intertwined around both your hearts be God's will. It is so easy in marriage to engage in a battle of the wills between what each of you wants. This produces a disconnected relationship over time, and the two of you will grow apart. You will be able to successfully resist this tendency and achieve true oneness only by seeking God's will together as you prayerfully pursue common goals. Your true strength will come not just from looking into each other's eyes, but by learning to look in the same direction. In short, from this point forward, learn to choose whenever possible, not self, but us. And perhaps even better would simply to think in terms of you can't seek God's will without seeking God, right? Having God at your side. Obviously, if you think about a strand, you know, it's fairly easy to break threads or things that are not bound together, but you take threads that are weak by themselves and you wrap them all up together with lots of them, and now you've got something that's strong, like rope that has three strands to it. And so we need that kind of strength in our lives, in our family, and in our friends. And the worst thing you can do is feeling alone and isolated. And may I suggest that even if you got 1,000 friends on Facebook, that's probably not the same as really knowing people and really having relationships. We're not talking about something here on the surface, but something that is meaningful. Another thing I wanted to share with you that I use this frequently in wedding ceremonies about the value of companionship. And my wife and I especially love this. It's called, I have the couple face one another and hold hands and look into each other's eyes. These are the hands of your new best friend, young and vibrant with love. These are the hands holding yours on your wedding day as you promise to love one another all the days of your life. These are the hands that will work together as together you build your future. These are the hands you will reach for as you laugh and cry, as you share your innermost secrets and dreams. These are the hands that will hold you tight as you struggle through life's difficult times. These are the hands that will comfort you when you are sick or console you when you're grieving. These are the hands that will countless times wipe the tears from your eyes, both tears of sorrow and joy. These are the hands that will tenderly lift your chin to look into your eyes that are filled completely with overwhelming love and desire. These are the hands that will passionately love you and will cherish you through the years for a lifetime of happiness. You may now kiss the bride. These are the hands. Isn't that beautiful? And that's, to me, a great, great explanation of what he's trying to say here about the value of companionship. What God wants is not just a human duet, but a holy triune, where you really both love God more than you love each other. That's strength. Reader's Digest had a contest about, you know, send in a one-sentence statement about friends, and they had a lot of neat sayings. But the one that won is one I really like, because one of the most important aspects of friendship is loyalty. And this speaks to that. A friend is someone who walks in when everybody else walks out. Richard Nixon said this: when you win, you hear from everybody. When you lose, you hear from your real friends who know you're hurting. He went on to say, Gerald Ford was with me and caring whether I won or lost. So, how does this fit with companionship with us today? Any thoughts? Again, can we often get so task-oriented that we give short drift to our friends and our relationships? I think so. And we're talking in the pulpit, a series on love. And all these things that we think are so important in this life, God says the essence of life is to love me with all your heart and to love the people around you. And yet that's not a message that reverberates very well. And I've never been asked to speak at a graduation, but if I were asked, I would not say what people would expect. all the stuff about success and degrees and, you know, prestige and the American dream. I talk to them about this. Don't let all this other stuff, which is peripheral, get in the way of what really matters. And we're just so focused on worldly success and wonder why so many people, even those who achieve it, not very happy people. And so better to be content and happy and walking with the Lord than it is to, well, what are those proverbs we've memorized, Gail, about better is a meal of vegetables than... Yeah. Yeah. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great wealth and turmoil therewith. Yeah, that's another statement of Solomon's. And that's what people need to be focused in on, is what really matters instead of all these worldly things. Okay. Anybody else got any thoughts? Any amens? Remember, this is a book about what is life. Let's go ahead and look at our lesson 8, some of the questions here. We've gone through really, if you'll turn the page over, let's look at the discussion questions. Would you rather have a lot of money or a few good friends? I imagine most people would say, can I have both? Just remember, no man is so poor as he who has only money. What is the difference between a friend and an acquaintance? What do you think? Okay. The acquaintance tends to be a fair weather friend. All right. Excellent, Roger. Yes, Lelania. Okay, that's interesting. They actually have done studies on this in the communication research, and the academic answer is choice and positive regard. In other words, an acquaintance tends to be somebody you just happen to be sitting next to at work. A friend is someone you choose to ask over for a meal. You know, let's get together outside of work. You know, acquaintances tend to be just people that happen to cross your path. Somebody you sit on the bus with on the way to work because you have the same schedule. You know, that kind of thing. More accidental. But friends are the family that you choose, right? Choice and positive regard. You don't necessarily have positive regard for every acquaintance. You don't even know them very well because they're just an acquaintance. But if you get to like them and look forward to their company and their fellowship, now they become friends. We don't talk about this very much, but in 3 John, the book ends, and he's talking about the family of God there, and he says, salute the friends by name. So one of the things the Bible says that your Christian family ought to be, yeah, your brother or sister, but it also says, the friends that you can count on. And if we're not that for each other, then we got a problem. We need to think about that and work on that, because we need to choose people that are going to be iron sharpeneth iron, and hopefully that we look forward spending time with. So who's your best friend, and what do you like best about him or her? You don't have to give any names, but what do you like best about your very best friends? What are the qualities that means so much?
They're there in the good and bad times.
Okay. All right. All right. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful, is what the proverb said. That's right. Yes. Sure. All right. Yeah, the care groups.
And I think everybody has the responsibility, which
All right. Shameless plug. And Lyle and the rest of us here say amen, because that's really one of the reasons, is because we want people to get together. All right. Enjoyed the discussion. Appreciate you all being here. We'll finish up chapter 4 and deal with lesson 9 in our workbook. And again, if you plan on being in the Wednesday night class and you don't have the book on heaven, please see me after class. Thanks for being here. Go out there and live on purpose for what really matters, right?